Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AOIS21.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and the production of the AS21 Podcast Network. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
Program tonight, Bill Murray, of course, and Billy Joel. I want to take a second here to say a couple of things about Ed Sullivan, the man for whom this theater is named. Here was a guy who every Sunday night had his own variety show on CBS for about 28 years, and certainly a hero in the history of broadcasting, and I believe it's safe to say a significant part of American culture of the day.
Absolutely.
And we're in this theater named for him, as I mentioned now. And it's, there's a sense, there's almost a palpable feeling that the man, his presence is still here. And I was wondering if maybe with your cooperation and if we have a second, I could try and contact the spirit of Ed Sullivan.
Sure.
All right. So I'm gonna from you, I'm going to need some of that spooky, swami kind of mysterious.
My specialty.
Okay, here you go. And I'm not really going into a trance, but I'm going to concentrate very hard. It's a little trick I learned on the Psychic Network.
Uh-huh.
Psychic Friends Hotline.
Psychic Friends Network.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to try and bring in the spirit of Ed Sullivan. See if he likes what we've done with the place.
Yeah, all right.
He showed up and said, "Ah, what a dump. I'm going home." All right, here we go. Ed Sullivan, now let's just see if we can't. Okay. Is he? Oh, my God, there he is. Look, Paul, it's...
Hustler, his new picture, A New Kind of Love, Paramount, co-stars with his wife, Joanne Woodward, and the picture's opening, as you know, to the United States now. They were supposed to be on our show tonight. Joanne's got a very bad cold. They're coming on some other time, but I want you to meet Paul Newman. Stand up there and take a bow, won't you, please?
Welcome to the program, Paul. Thank you very much for driving by.
Where the hell are the singing cats?
Oh, no. This is not cats. This is my TV show.
I'm in the wrong theater.
Oh, well, that's embarrassing.
Where the hell are the singing cats? 1993. David Letterman's first episode on CBS, 26 and a half years ago. Cats was such an astonishingly common reference point in the American Carnival that David Letterman could use Paul Newman to pull off an astonishing comic bait and switch in an extremely crucial episode for him. And everybody in America knew that the singing cats was talking about this infected zip on the lip of Broadway that's run for nearly 40 years. Why was Cats a mega hit? I have absolutely no idea, except to say that it was sprinkled with that magic dust with which Andrew Lloyd Webber sparked his astonishing run of success. At the heart of Webber's musical talent, if it can be said to have one, is a real melodic gift. There is no question his shows are proscenium slope-to-slope packed with tunes. Are they great tunes? Well, it probably depends on whom you ask. I wouldn't say so, but even so, it's a real gift. But even if Webber's shows have real melodies and his gift for melody is astonishingly progenitive, they are so maddeningly catchy because they're not exactly complex melodies. They are so easy to remember that they're grating. Compare one of the most memorable tunes of Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Memory, turn your face to the moonlight.
It's the definition of four square. Eight completely symmetrical bars. The harmonies are just as predictable. Not a surprise anywhere to be found. You'll find the same predictability in Close Every Door to Me or Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. Now, compare that with probably the most famous melody of his contemporary, Paul McCartney.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly.
A seven-bar asymmetrical melody preceded by a three-bar introduction with chromatic walking bass line and then the intrusion of a string quartet on the eighth bar. If you know music, this is incredibly untraditional and complicated. When it comes to musical creativity, this is the real thing. Andrew Lloyd Webber is extremely competent at what he does. Is it artistically creative? Well, not really. It's generic purveyance of maddeningly catchy earworms with electronic scores and simple syncopations that sound uncannily like soft rock. Fleetwood Mac, Hall & Oates, Phil Collins, and yes, Billy Joel. Rock music completely defanged of its subversion, mass marketed and pastiched for an audience who thinks that everything in the world is just fine. The absence of musical content tarted up with literally millions of dollars strewn about the stage. The Broadway truism of the time is that you went home from Andrew Lloyd Webber shows singing the scenery. The true genius of Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals was not Webber or his lyricist Tim Rice. It was producers like Cameron McIntosh and Bill Kenwright who perceived within the mind-numbing catchiness of Webber's melodies a blank slate onto which they could mount an unpredictable theater experience that is truly cinematic, with music and lyrics that are just barely good enough to support such high-concept theatrical machines without drawing attention to themselves. It's also precisely what made Michael Jackson and Madonna. The true genius in their songs is not the songs, but the videos which accompanied their release. And what you're remembering in their songs is not just the music itself, but the recall of the entire visual production. And so successful was that deceptive formula that after a not entirely successful run of shows that included Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Jesus Christ Superstar, and Evita, the Webber juggernaut realized that so based was their formula on production design that they could literally make a review show about Cats with no plot whatsoever, and it would be a bigger hit than West Side Story or Gypsy. To be an unassailable success, production, not substance, is what it generally took to distinguish oneself artistically in late 20th century Anglophonia. Here's the first two paragraphs of Frank Rich's 1982 review, back when nobody knew he had a political thought in his head, and he was merely the New York Times theater critic known as the Butcher of Broadway. And yet, butcher Cats, he didn't really. Here's the quote. "There's a reason why Cats is likely to lurk around Broadway for a long time, and it may not be the one you expect. It's not that this collection of anthropomorphic variety turns is a brilliant musical, or that it powerfully stirs the emotions, or that it has an idea in its head. Nor is the probable appeal of Cats a function of the publicity that has accompanied the show's every purr since it first stalked London 17 months ago. No, the reason why people will hunger to see Cats is far more simple and primal than that. It's a musical that transports the audience into a complete fantasy that could only exist in the theater and yet, these days, only rarely does. Whatever the other failings and excesses, even banalities, of Cats, it believes in purely theatrical magic, and on that faith it unquestionably delivers." End quote. Rarely exists in the theater. Why is that? Because theater is not movies, and most attempts to make theater look realistically high concept is a disaster. Obviously, there are exceptions, but would it add anything to the experience if the storm in King Lear had real water and we felt the wind blow? When the statue in Don Giovanni sends the titular antagonist to hell, would it really be any more frightening if we saw hell? The music in Don Giovanni already does such heavy lifting. All the stage needs to make it work is a trapdoor. Sweeney Todd's had a whole series of huge, grandly operatic productions, but I can't imagine any Sweeney Todd more devastating than the one I saw in London, 2004, which took place in a theater barely the size of a lecture hall. Every singer played an instrument to accompany the other singers, and the staging was as abstract as it is in any Greek drama. Theater, as the long tradition of poetics always understood it, has its roots as a religious rite for the worship of Greek gods. And its synergy comes from the faith it generates within the audience that we are conjuring a different reality through incredibly false means. It was a much more complex vision of worship than much of what we have in today's monotheism. But that transubstantiation is at the essence of so many of the most basic religious rites, not just in the obvious, the Catholic Eucharist or Communion, but in nearly any element of the Jewish Passover Seder, which asks its participants to do nothing less than to transcend time to partake in ancient acts of Jewish history through religious symbols, or even in the Islamic prohibition of images of the Prophet or Allah. In all three religions, the issue at stake is the belief that the most banal material can very easily become transcendent. It's all pure theater, but theater, good theater, and there's no better theater than religion, is very, very real to the people convinced to believe in it. All of this partakes of the same process that Catholics call transubstantiation, in which what was a moment ago completely terrestrial and humdrum becomes divine and of a different world. But movies have their roots in science. The manipulation of light, which was once thought divine by electricity, the forces of the divine given measurable scientific form. Movies already take place in a fake space. So on a movie screen, the more they can convince us the effects are real, the more vivid our experience. Movies can take us to faraway lands, but admittedly, with a lot of exceptions, particularly in movies' early days, the fantasy must look plausible. If the space effects in Star Wars and the alternate universe of Lord of the Rings looked implausible, we would laugh at them. If the Velociraptors in Jurassic Park and the Terminator did not move as though they could jump out of the screen, we would never be scared. And if the violence in The Godfather or Schindler's List looked fake, we would never remember these movies. Imagine a fake-looking desert in Lawrence of Arabia or The Searchers. Imagine a psycho that isn't cut quickly enough between shots to hide the fact that you don't see the knife going in. The effects in movies are so little unless we believe we've actually seen the real thing. But the realness of theater is right in front of you. You need fantasy for theater to work. And for better or worse, nothing exists more in the land of the imagination than singing cats. I have never seen the show live. I can't imagine I'd like it much, but I completely understand why people do. Theater needs us to suspend disbelief, and nothing makes us acclimate to the suspension of disbelief so quickly as...
Jellicle cats, come out tonight. Jellicle cats, come one, come all.
The Jellicle moon is shining bright. Jellicles, come to the Jellicle ball.
But even a show that's good theater doesn't have to be anywhere near this stupid. How the f*** did a show this dumb ever sustain the cash flow year after year of a small country? The answer is that the economics of theater, the economics of America itself, demanded megaproduction on a scale unextant before the oil crisis of 1973. In a balanced national economy during a period when the world was so imbalanced that America controlled more than 50% of the world's GDP and a large American middle class was unassailably secure, it was very easy to make theatrical and cinematic productions of middling expense. A success would make a medium amount of money, a failure would lose a medium amount of money, and whether the play ran for a week or the play ran for a year, the producers would simply move on to the next show. But by the mid-70s, all that was over, and shows which failed stood to lose so much money that you had to bet everything on every show, because as always in the arts, some shows are guaranteed to fail. And therefore, every success must recoup the costs of the failures. Even Andrew Lloyd Webber had two failures during the 70s when it seemed as though he could do no wrong. Therefore, these enormous investments require concepts that keep these millions of dollars as absolutely safe as they can be. So rather than tell any number of astonishingly subversive stories, we get a musical about...
Oh, well, and never was there ever a cat so clever as magical Mr. Mustapheles.
Cats is still on Broadway, 38 years into its run, but as a whole, the world basically forgot about Cats, and there is so little reason to remember it. Cats was a product of 1980. Everything about it is bad David Bowie. The score is B-level synth pop, the costume Ziggy Stardust with fur. It has no discernible plot, no discernible character development. Virtually every song is based on an introduction to a different cat, and practically every cat is based on a cat pun. Extra points if you get the pun in that sentence. That is the entirety of the show! It is literally a show about cat puns, and it's run for nearly 40 years! So yes, I saw Cats 4 times. Why? Because it's there. It is far and away my favorite movie this year. No movie this year was as good as Cats was bad. It is a failure of genius. It takes the most astonishing artistic risks and fails at every single one of them. I have also failed to see Cats twice. One time, the movie had so many technical glitches that I took it as a sign that it was bad juju to see a terrible movie like that again, and I walked out. I then went to the theater to see it another 4 times. I was also thrown out of... Okay. I was also thrown out of another showing, my second that day. You heard both halves of that sentence correctly. What happened was that I snuck a computer into Cats earlier that day to take notes because obviously after all this, I had to do a podcast on Cats. I snuck the computer in again tonight to take more notes on whatever I had missed the first time, and considering that most of the last viewing was spent looking at my computer, it's highly likely that there was more to find out. So I go back late that night, and everything goes according to plan. No computer check, even though I'd gotten so cocky that it's not even in a bag. I just tucked it under the flap of my coat. I go into the theater, and of course, a weekday 10:30 showing of a flop is utterly empty. But then I realize, oh shit, I forgot to open the file on Google where my notes are, and there's no Wi-Fi. So unless I want to take notes on my phone where the keyboard is, of course, extremely small, I have to go outside and ask them if there's Wi-Fi and hope they have a sense of humor and pity. There are 3 at the desk, and 2 of them look like they'd have been cool with it, but one of them clearly was more of a stickler than the others. He takes 1 look at me and doesn't let me go back in unless I give him the computer. So I say, if I can't take my computer, I'm not seeing this movie. It's Cats. He says, but this is the movie you came for. I say that I came to take notes on the movie. So he says, why? Are you a reviewer? And I just go, yes. Let me call the manager, he says. He calls the manager. The manager comes. The manager says, it doesn't matter whether or not he says he's a reviewer. He might be here to record the movie illegally. It's Cats. You might distract people with your typing and the light. I'm the only person in the theater. It's Cats! The manager says, I'm sorry, the studio is very clear on this. So I say, well, I'm here to write about it. If I can't write about it, there's no point in seeing the movie. It's Cats. You owe me a free pass. So he goes, all right, and dejectedly gives me a free pass. So I managed to stifle it until I got in the car, but from the moment I got in, I cry-laughed like Jack Nicholson's Joker for 20 minutes and still felt dizzy from the rest of the night from the lack of control over my lungs. So I have now gone to the theater to see Cats 6 times, and I feel like I've memorized the trailers. I also stayed routinely to count the credits because the sheer amount of talent, skill, and love that went into making this movie is on the same level as The Wizard of Oz. This is a perfect movie. It gets everything wrong. And like a great movie, its failure completely rewards repeat viewings. Any great work of art is self-renewing. Every time you see it, you find new meanings. And every time I've seen Cats, I have found new ways in which this movie is risible. Cats, the movie, cost $95 million. With a friend, I counted all of the credits. 18 prop dressers, 12 model drawers, 5 third assistant sound editors, 5 shooting electricians, 6 rigging electricians, 6 more electrical riggers, 10 costume standbys, 6 seamstresses, 8 hair and makeup artists, 7 set PAs, 3 dialect coaches, 3 unit medics, at least 7 assistant directors, 4 physiotherapists, 4 conductors, 6 orchestrators, 8 digital animators, 5 visual effects producers, 5 visual effects coordinators. Eric Fellner, whoever he is, has 4 assistants. 5 animation directors, 12 animation supervisors, 12 effects production managers, a couple hundred digital artists with 12 department heads, and roughly 140 other special effects artists, and literally at least 1,000 or many more visual effects supervisors. There is even a cat movement specialist, and all of this for a musical about cat puns. I could take us through every song in the musical and show exactly how stupid the music and the lyrics are, but what of the movie itself? We will talk about that in the next podcast. You cannot possibly be looking forward to that podcast more than I.
Much of what happens, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker, a production of the AS21 Podcast Network. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past. If you like this podcast, consider becoming a patron of the AS21 Podcast Network. Visit www.patreon.com/AS21 and donate today. Any amount will unlock special perks including bonus episodes and behind-the-scenes tidbits. That's patreon.com/AYS21.
Copyright 2019, AS21 Media, LLC, all rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?